BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Donald McLeod, and thanks for downloading this highlights version of Composer of the Week. There's information on all the music you'll hear, as well as our terms of use, on the Radio 3 website at bbc.co.uk/radio3. No one could have predicted that my composer this week would end up as the grand old man of Russian music. He did indeed become one of the most influential composers in Russia in the latter part of the 19th century, a key figure in establishing a national sound for Russian music and in spreading the popularity of Russian music overseas. He was also, surely, the only man to have composed a musical portrait of the famous statue of that micturating little chap in Brussels, the mannequin Piss. As a child, though, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov wasn't really that interested in music. He had a big brother who was in the Imperial Russian Navy, and through him and his letters home from exotic locations, young Nikolai became obsessed by something he'd never seen, the ocean. Wave after wave, advance and retreat, their spray covering the crests. With the thunder and splashing, my soul has awoken, the kin of the clamorous sea. Rimsky-Korsakov's relationship with the sea would come to define much of his life, his musical development, and the compositions he's remembered by, and I'm going to be focusing on that maritime perspective today. Ignited by those letters from his elder brother Voin, written from aboard various vessels of the Russian Imperial Navy, as a boy, Nikolai, not yet even a teenager, became infected with a passionate desire to see these wildly romantic locations, impossibly far away, that his big brother had actually visited, even more urgently, perhaps, given that, at the age of 12, he'd only left the town of Tikhvin, 200 kilometres east of St. Petersburg, 3 or 4 times. Who wouldn't have hero-worshipped such a big brother? Voin was doing research in the Sea of Japan and has had a small archipelago named after him, his voyages subsequently immortalised by the writer Goncharov in his travel novel The Frigate Pallada. In fact, there were many sailors in the Rimsky-Korsakov family, so it was entirely natural that young Nicky set his heart on going to sea himself. He taught himself long lists of nautical terms and even rigged up a model brig. The ocean he fell in love with was one he'd never seen, though. It must have represented both freedom and the exotic unknown to him, as it must have done later for much of his landlocked Russian audience. From what he gleaned from his big brother's letters and from devouring all the books he could find that had anything to do with the sea, young Nicky pieced together a fantasy nautical world which would be reflected in his music throughout his life. This is the world of adventure, the world of Ishmael and Ahab, of Robinson Crusoe and of Sinbad the Sailor. Rimsky-Korsakov's symphonic suite, Scheherazade, was inspired by episodes from the tales of the Arabian Nights. He said of his score, "All I had desired was that the hearer should carry away the impression that it is beyond doubt an oriental narrative of some numerous and varied fairy tale wonders."
Thank you. Hello, I'm composer Michael Barclay, and I just want to let you know about my podcast, which I think you might enjoy. It's called Private Passions. Every week, a different guest chooses the classical music they're passionate about. People like Alan Bennett, Jan Ravens, Grayson Perry. And what I love about it is how much people reveal of themselves when they're talking about and listening to the music which moves them. Just search for Private Passions in BBC Sounds. Download the free app now.
Despite the fact that his elder brother was very discouraging about the idea of Nikolai joining the Navy, he considered his fellow officers a slack and lazy bunch. On the brink of his teenage years, Nikolai left his mother for the first time and went to St. Petersburg to enter the Corps of Naval Cadets. A fictionalized episode from his Navy service was made into a film in 1947 called Song of Scheherazade. In reality, Nicky seems to have been a good cadet and popular with his comrades, but his letters to his parents inquiring about how his canaries are doing and how his papa's piano playing is coming along make it clear that he was terribly homesick. Rimsky was having piano lessons from a man called Ulrich, described as a mediocre cellist and a worse pianist, but evidently had little enthusiasm for them. What really sparked his interest in music was opera. In his first year as a cadet at the Marine Corps school, he would board during the week, but at the weekends he went to stay at the home of one of his classmates' families, the Golovins, and they took him to the opera, and that opened up a new world to him. Glinka became his hero. He changed his piano teacher, and it was this new teacher, a much better pianist, Fyodor Kanil, who introduced the young Niki to the composers Mili Balakirev, Cesar Cui, and Mussorgsky. Rimsky-Korsakov showed Balakirev some watery piano pieces and the beginnings of a fledgling symphony. The elder composer encouraged him, broadening his musical knowledge and also introducing him to literature, Gogol, Lermontov and Pushkin. Rimsky had completed and orchestrated three movements of the symphony when it and his new friendships were interrupted by the call of the ocean. In 1862, Rimsky-Korsakov left the Naval College as a garde marine and was posted to the clipper, Almaz. Once they set sail, the crew spent their leisure time discussing politics and reading. There was a good library on board with books in French and English, including Shakespeare, John Stuart Mill, the Iliad and the Odyssey, a book which would later inspire another sea-related work. From Homer, subtitled A Prelude Cantata, consists mostly of a long and highly pictorial orchestral overture that depicts the episode from the Odyssey where Ulysses' raft is destroyed in a violent storm conjured up by the god Poseidon. As it happened, the first port of call for Rimsky's ship, the Almaz, was Gravesend in Kent, where the vessel went for renewal of the rigging. With the ship docked for nearly 4 months, he obviously had a certain amount of time on his hands. There were sightseeing trips up to London to see the Tower of London, Westminster Abbey and the Crystal Palace, and he was able to put in some work on the symphony. Not surprisingly, there was no piano on the ship, but he bought a harmonium and had it brought on board. Evidently, he made a couple of excursions to local pubs, and it's hilarious to read that he treated the customers to a playthrough of what he'd written so far. What can the drinkers have made of the first performance of part of what was called the First Russian Symphony? But then, the repairs completed, the Almaz was on the move again, ordered home, first of all, by way of New York to Rio de Janeiro. That leg of the trip took 65 days under sail, then via Cape Horn and the Pacific. Then back to Europe, to Nice, Marseille and Genoa. Meanwhile, Rimsky-Korsakov's ideas of a career in music were fading. I had become an officer dilettante who sometimes enjoyed playing or listening to music, but all my dreams of artistic activity had completely flown away, nor did I regret them. Nonetheless, he did finish the symphony and posted a score of the work to Balakirev. We'll hear the slow second movement, which, as you'll hear, is clearly based on a folk song that Balakirev had sent him expressly for the purpose. Balakirev was a very controlling character with those he took under his wing, and when Rimsky-Korsakov got back to St. Petersburg in 1865, Balakirev suggested that the young composer should do some further work on the symphony, which he dutifully did, writing a trio for the scherzo and reorchestrating the entire thing. Balakirev then conducted the premiere of the symphony in December 1865 at one of his free school concerts. It went down well, and as the audience applauded enthusiastically, they were surprised to see a young man in naval uniform make his way up onto the platform to take a bow. Regulations stipulated that officers should remain in uniform even when off duty. There are a couple of photographs of the young Rimsky in his naval uniform. In the earlier of them, holding a shiny helmet, he's slightly chubby and baby-faced. In the later picture, presumably to make himself look more mature and give him a bit of gravitas, he's grown a bushy moustache. It was Balakirev's fascination with another composer, the pianist Anton Rubinstein, and his Ocean Symphony, which led Rimsky-Korsakov to write his next sea-based work, the musical tableau Sadko. Balakirev had originally offered the subject to Mussorgsky, but he was more than happy for Rimsky-Korsakov to take on the task, counting on the naval officer's love of the sea to help him create something exceptional. Rimsky began work in June 1867, during a three-week holiday at his brother's summer villa at Tervajoki, near Vyborg, with what was perhaps a helpful interruption, a month's naval cruise in the Gulf of Finland. Sadko is about a seafaring minstrel from Novgorod, who's a kind of fabulous version of the great promoter of Russian music, Mitrofan Belyaev, with his ambitions to set sail for distant climes and open up new markets for Russian wares. Composer would later write an entire opera on that same subject. This earlier score of Rimsky-Korsakov was written either side of a naval cruise in the Gulf of Finland in 1867. It would be another 6 years before Nicky could properly devote himself to composition and be seen in public without the requirement to wear his naval uniform. In 1873, he was appointed to the new civilian role of Inspector of Naval Bands, a job he threw himself into with gusto. "I parted with delight with both my military status and my officer's uniform," and added later, "henceforth I was a musician, officially and incontestably." His zeal in hunting down bad instruments and wrong notes was commendable, but he also took advantage of his new position to study the whole business of military bands and their instruments, which proved to be quite an effective way of filling some of the huge gaps in his rather sketchy musical education. Nowadays, Rimsky would cause chaos at port security as the scanners detected very suspicious objects in his luggage. When he and his wife went on holiday, among his baggage he would pack a few instruments, a trombone perhaps, a flute or a clarinet. He would then have caused vociferous complaints from his fellow guests in any hotels he stayed in, since, by his own admission, regardless of the neighbours, he learned, if not to play them, at least to come to some understanding of how they should be played. These explorations led him to embark on a colossal treatise on instrumentation, a voyage he never completed, but it did result in something to mitigate his neighbour's annoyance, a concerto for the unusual forces of trombone and military band. Rimsky's concerto certainly puts the trombone through its paces, including some athletic running up and down the rigging. "I'm rather dry by nature," Rimsky-Korsakov said of himself in one of his letters. And that is rather the impression we get of the composer from people who knew him, like his publisher, Vladimir Bessel. "Always even-tempered, precise. What he said, he always did. Serious, businesslike, simple and considerate, in the highest degree honourable. Straightforward and self-controlled, incredibly conscientious. A thoroughly decent man, then, but possibly just a tad dull." Rimsky-Korsakov's life was certainly utterly different from the wild and colourful things we read about Mussorgsky or Tchaikovsky, and yet his music teems with mystery, fantasy and otherness. The music critic Alexander Serov once wrote that Mr. Rimsky-Korsakov, gifted with enormous talent, glitters amid his unfortunate entourage like a diamond among cobblestones. It's that exotic element of his work that I'm going to be exploring today. To Rimsky-Korsakov's Russian audiences, the exoticism of the East meant the far-off parts of their own country, spanning as it does the continents of both Europe and Asia. It was only in the reign of Peter the Great that Russia began to look at the East through Western eyes, and the common currency of this Orientalist imagery was largely minted by the two most significant Russian poets of the 19th century, Pushkin and Lermontov, who both visited the southern regions of the Caucasus and Crimea on numerous occasions and produced a wealth of masterpieces of literature reflecting their impressions, forever imbuing those places with a sense of romanticism for Russians. Mili Balakirev's collection of folk songs, gathered on his holidays in the Caucasus, introduced this element of exoticism into the music of the mighty handful. Rimsky-Korsakov himself first tried to capture the music of the Orient in his Antar Symphony. That was a time when he was disenchanted with Balakirev's controlling influence on the group, so instead he borrowed from Borodin a French volume of Arab melodies collected in Algiers. Rimsky was particularly proud of having composed a melody for Antar with florid Oriental embellishments, and he later boasted that the abundant use of Oriental themes lent my composition an odd turn of its own, hardly in wide use until then. It was Balakirev who supplied Rimsky-Korsakov with the subject of his symphony, though. A Russian version of the legend of Antar, a 6th century warrior poet whose verses were so revered that they were displayed in Islam's holiest shrine at Mecca. Thank you. I had no right to call Antar a symphony. My Antar was a poem, suite, legend, anything you like, but not a symphony. Legends like Antar seemed to attract Rimsky, perhaps partly because fairy tales are worlds of conflict, worlds where the commonplace is confused with the fantastic, naivete with sophistication, the romantic with the humorous. His biographer, Gerald Abraham, sees these contrasts as mirroring oppositions within the composer's own nature. The poetry of pagan worship fascinated Rimsky, and he collected as many of the traditional songs connected with the seasons of the year as he could. He had woven some of the old songs he collected into the fabric of two of his operas, and following up their success, he composed an orchestral piece originally called Baba Yaga, but which later became Legend, also known as Fairy Tale or Skazka, which conjures up the fantastic and vividly colourful atmosphere of Russian folk tales. Rimsky apparently had in mind the prologue to Pushkin's Ruslan and Lyudmila when he wrote his Skazka, in which a tomcat circles around an oak tree, conjuring up magical images. His adoring pupil, Vasily Yastrebtsev, who wrote a book of memoirs of the composer, asked him what exactly was depicted in the five sections of this orchestral tale. Rimsky's answer was, "I believe this overture has in it everything that each person perceives in it, so you can make up your own stories." Perhaps one reason behind Rimsky's attraction to these magical fairy tale worlds lies in the fact that he evidently had that joining of the senses condition known as synesthesia, whereby two or more of the senses that are normally experienced separately correspond with each other. This was something he had in common with the composer Alexander Scriabin. Both men associated colours with music, but they didn't always agree on the colours involved. According to Rachmaninoff, who heard them discussing this, they were agreed that the key of D major was golden brown. But for Scriabin, E-flat major was linked with red-purple, while for Rimsky-Korsakov it was blue. Otherwise, Rimsky doesn't appear to have cared much for Scriabin, describing him as warped, posing and self-opinionated. We're going to hear next one of his best-loved works, famous for the vividness of its orchestral colours. Rimsky worked on the Capriccio Espagnol during the summer of 1887, after a period of disillusionment and writer's block. It was a piece he constructed out of the sketches he made for a planned virtuoso fantasy for violin on Spanish themes. "According to my plans," Rimsky said, "the Capriccio was to glitter with dazzling orchestral colour, and, manifestly, I had not been wrong." The audience, which heard that music for the first time, was so delighted by it that it had to be immediately encored. In later life, Rimsky found the perfect frame for his exotic music in the form of opera, which you may remember was what had fired his interest in music in the first place. It was working on an opera that got Rimsky out of his second creative crisis after he'd been diagnosed as suffering from cerebral neurasthenia and ordered complete mental rest. In addition, following a long illness, his little daughter Masha died in the summer of 1893. First, he wrote the opera Christmas Eve, then came Sadko, followed by an opera every 18 months or so between 1893 and 1908. To end today, we'll hear from his final opera, one which takes us again into fantastic realms, The Golden Cockerel. By this time, Rimsky's relationship with the East had changed, and the exoticism in The Golden Cockerel acts as satire. He pushed his usual musical language, highly coloured instrumentation, sinuous melodies, folk motifs, to preposterous extremes. Nothing in The Golden Cockerel feels remotely real. The work was a reaction to the political unrest that surrounded Rimsky-Korsakov at the time. It's about a fat, lazy autocrat engaged in idiotic warfare in the context of a fairy tale or fable with a cartoon-like quality that was reinforced by the brilliantly coloured sets by Ivan Bilibin for the first production. The Golden Cockerel's mockery of authority ruffled the censor's feathers to such an extent that it wasn't performed until after Rimsky's death. Mitrofan Belyaev had the good luck to inherit the biggest timber business in Russia. In his case, money really did grow on trees. This Maecenas was an amateur viola player and decided to spend some of his fortune in pursuit of his great pleasure, music. He established a regular series of musical evenings in St. Petersburg at which string quartets were played, called, in fashionable French, Les Vendredis. That was a movement by Rimsky-Korsakov. Belyaev's appearance on the scene was furiously resented by Mili Balakirev, whose former protégés now deserted him. Rimsky-Korsakov was the youngest of the so-called mighty handful which had gathered around him, and which had included, until his death, Modest Mussorgsky, as well as Alexander Borodin and César Cui, aiming to create a distinctively Russian music. Balakirev despised Belyaev as a man pursuing his patronage of art out of vanity and conceit. He said of Rimsky-Korsakov that he sold his talent for 30 pieces of silver to Satan, who, disastrously for Russian music, revealed himself in the form of Belyaev. Despite Balakirev's claims, Rimsky-Korsakov's music wasn't linked purely to money, but was deeply intertwined with a pride in his Russian background, which Belyaev supported just as much as Balakirev had done. Rimsky-Korsakov was from a noble family. There was a lieutenant general in the 18th century, Peter Voinovich, one of whose sons married a princess. Peter Voinovich's father, Ivan Rimsky-Korsakov, an admiral, had been, briefly, one of the lovers of Catherine the Great, who got the Order of the Boot when he was caught in flagrante with the courtesan. Rimsky himself had a series of modest rebellions throughout his life. The Mighty Five in themselves constituted a rebellion against the academic approach of the conservatoire. They were all self-trained amateur musicians, bound together to some extent by the myth they had created of being more authentically Russian than their contemporaries, closer to the native soil than the classic academy. 5 years after he joined the group, Rimsky wrote an overture on three Russian themes. In his autobiography, My Musical Life, Rimsky-Korsakov tells us that one fine day, Mikhail Pavlovich Azanchevsky, the newly appointed director of the St. Petersburg Conservatoire, came knocking at the door. To the composer's astonishment, he found that he was being offered the post of professor of composition at the conservatoire. Azanchevsky thought that by hiring Rimsky-Korsakov, a 27-year-old naval officer — Rimsky was still officially in the Imperial Russian Navy and, in accordance with regulations, still wore naval uniform — he would be getting a much-needed injection of new blood, cashing in on the success of the mighty handful and bringing them aboard his establishment vessel. Rimsky had been getting rave reviews, so he must be a musical expert. Mustn't he? What Azanchevsky didn't know was that Rimsky was an absolute novice with no musical training at all. As Rimsky confessed in his memoirs, "I had not written a single counterpoint in my life. I had hardly any notion of the structure of a fugue." This was brought acutely to his attention because this was the kind of thing he should now be teaching others. As he put it, "Having undeservedly become a conservatoire professor, I soon became one of its best students." Like any teacher employed to teach a subject they don't know, he had to try to keep one lesson ahead of his pupils. The income from his new job at the conservatoire provided security. He became engaged to and then married Nadezhda Pergold. Nadezhda was a composer herself and an accomplished pianist, and she played a very important role in his musical development. However, taking on his new role was read as an act of rebellion, even treason, by the members of the Gang of Five. Rimsky-Korsakov's Third Symphony drew their particular criticism. They found it dry and were strongly critical of the scoring and of the clogged contrapuntal texture when he showed it to them in 1873. We'll hear the lively scherzo. After that improbable start, Rimsky-Korsakov would put in 34 years in his role at the conservatoire, not without controversy. In the course of the First Russian Revolution in 1905, which came in the wake of the disasters of the war with Japan, students naturally took a prominent role in the events. The initial disturbances at the university spread to the conservatoire in St. Petersburg, and then full-scale political ferment took hold of the whole city. Rimsky became a bit of a revolutionary himself. He took the side of the students and represented their case to the authorities. One day in March, with the conservatoire building surrounded by police, many of them mounted, Rimsky sent the director, August Bernhardt, who, awkwardly to say the least, was a former pupil of his, a demand for his resignation. The upshot was that the conservatoire was closed, more than 100 pupils were expelled, and Rimsky and Bernhardt were dismissed from the staff. He then found himself, far from vilified, inundated with letters of support. He became a kind of revolutionary hero. Matters came to a head with a student performance of his work Kashchei the Immortal, which turned into a political demonstration, and as such Rimsky soon found the police issuing orders forbidding the performance of his music in St. Petersburg. "My position was unbearable and absurd," he said. Kashchei the Immortal is an amalgam of Russian and other folk tales, including Tristan and Isolde. He's a kind of Russian Klingsor, an evil sorcerer who's imprisoned a princess. The secret of Kashchei's immortality turns out to lie frozen in the tears of his daughter, Kashcheyevna, who is a kind of Kundry figure. Kashchei wasn't the first of Rimsky's operas to run into controversy, nor would it be the last. His epic Sadko was refused by the Mariinsky Imperial Theatre, and evidently Tsar Nicholas II personally. He didn't find the opera engaging enough. Faced with that snub, Rimsky was saved by a train, a whole network of trains, in fact. Sava Mamontov, a railway entrepreneur and a great music lover, set up his own private opera company and in 1897 offered to put on Sadko. Rimsky-Korsakov agreed. It allowed him, as he said, to spite you-know-who. That wasn't the last time Rimsky-Korsakov courted controversy with the Tsar. Daringly, he put a Russian emperor on stage in his bitter satire, The Golden Cockerel. The censor's nose twitched furiously, detecting subversive elements. The doddery king Dodon, his fratricidal sons and incompetent subservient courtiers were thought to be thinly disguised portraits of Tsar Nicholas II and his court. Listen with your soul to the whispering of the reeds, the chatter of the oak wood. Understand and take to heart. Then from your lips the rhythmical octaves will flow like nature's own music. A glimpse there of Rimsky-Korsakov's pantheistic beliefs that art, poetry and music will be at their best when inspired by nature. Rimsky-Korsakov was fond of telling people that he derived his love of folk songs from one of his grandmothers and his love of religious ceremonies and rites from the other. Today, I'm going to be exploring the connections between the two in the work and life of a man who professed to be an atheist. Rimsky-Korsakov began his second opera, May Night, in early 1878. He said it was a work of particular importance for him. It marked a turning point because, despite the fact that the score does contain some contrapuntal music, he felt he had nevertheless cast off the shackles of counterpoint. He scored it much in the style of Glinka. May Night is based on a Ukrainian folk tale by Gogol, and Rimsky-Korsakov cast off those shackles by using Ukrainian folk song melodies. We'll hear the substantial overture to May Night. It's a tapestry of some of the opera's most memorable moments. Stravinsky, who was a pupil of Rimsky's, once commented that Rimsky-Korsakov had a mind that was closed to any religious or metaphysical idea. Yet, in much of his work, you can see strains of pantheism, and there's a good deal of evidence that he wasn't as closed to spirituality as that comment suggests. In the summer of 1880, he rented an estate for his family in Stelyovo, what he called a genuine Russian village, near Luga, about 140 kilometres south of St. Petersburg. It was where their children's nanny came from. "The ancient Russian names of the surrounding places threw me into raptures," he said. Rimsky recalled, "For the first time in my life, I spent the summer in the heart of the Russian countryside. Everything delighted me. The lovely garden with its multitude of cherry and apple trees, the wild flowers and ceaseless singing of the birds, all this peculiarly harmonised with my pantheistic feeling at the time and with my delight in the subject of the snow maiden. An overgrown tree stump suggested a wood demon. The echoes heard from the balcony must surely be the voices of wood sprites. Not even the sultry weather and the thunderstorms, with a bolt of lightning that landed so close to the house it knocked his wife unconscious, could spoil it." Rimsky felt truly in touch with the ancient world of pagan Russia here, the world that had inspired May Night and was now inspiring the Snow Maiden, which he began to work on the day of their arrival. The poetry of pagan worship fascinated Rimsky, and he collected as many of the traditional songs connected with the seasons as he could. "The people, as a nation," he said, "sing their ceremonial songs by force of habit and custom, neither understanding nor suspecting what really underlies these ceremonies and games." Rimsky said, "My mild interest in the ancient Russian customs and heathen pantheism flamed up there. There could be no better subject in the whole world than this, no more poetic figures than the Snow Maiden, Lel, or the Spring Fairy, no better religion and philosophy of life than the worship of the sun god, Yarilo." Rimsky later confessed that at this time he actually began to pray to nature, to a crooked old tree stump, to some willow or century-old oak, to the forest stream, to the lake, even to a great head of cabbage, to a black ram, or at the horrible cockcrow scattering the sorcery of the night. "In all these things, I saw something peculiar and supernatural." I mentioned that Rimsky was fond of saying he'd gained his love of folk songs from one grandmother and of religion from the other. His mother's eccentric elder brother, known as Uncle Pipon, had two passions himself: the songs of the peasants and worshipping at the great monastery of the Blessed Virgin at Tikhvin, which faced the Rimsky-Korsakov's house across the river. It's an absolutely magical-looking building, as if the great illustrator and stage designer Ivan Bilibin had painted it. Bilibin designed fabulous productions of many of Rimsky-Korsakov's operas in the 20s and 30s. The main church building is a classic 16th-century Russian church, painted white, with five sky-blue onion domes, a large central one and four smaller ones at the corners. At each of the corners there are small pavilions painted in brilliant colours, red and creamy yellow, with bright green copper roofs. The church houses one of the most revered icons in the whole of Russia, the 14th-century Theotokos of Tikhvin, a Madonna and Child, which has had remarkable adventures in its lifetime. The bell tower at Tikhvin is really remarkable. I've never seen one like it. It's an extended gallery of bells mounted in a line under five arches, each of the arches topped by a tall pointed spire. There are 13 bells altogether, a huge bass one at one end and graduating sizes in the other arches. You can imagine what an impression such an amazing panoply of bells must have made on young Nikolai, growing up there, hearing them drifting across the river. The sounds of the monastery, of its bells, and of the monks chanting find echoes in many of Rimsky's works, as does the cry of the monastery herald in The Snow Maiden. When he came to compose his Russian Easter festival overture, Rimsky based it on a number of authentic liturgical themes. The mood gradually builds to a feeling of exaltation, out of which emerges the Russian Easter chant known as the Obichod, Christ is risen. As Rimsky said in his memoirs, the legendary and heathen side of the holiday, this transition from the gloomy and mysterious evening of Passion Saturday to the unbridled pagan religious merrymaking of the morn of Easter Sunday, is what I was eager to reproduce in my overture. Rimsky had a complicated relationship with religion. He loved the rituals of the Orthodox Church, but identified as an atheist, and, as we've heard, along with many of his contemporaries, including the playwright Anton Chekhov, he was attracted to pantheism. Tsar Alexander III was very strong on Orthodox thought, and when he came to the throne in 1883, following his brother's death, various changes were made to the way the imperial court chapel was run. He got rid of the existing musicians and appointed Balakirev as the new superintendent of the chapel. And rather surprisingly, Balakirev chose Rimsky-Korsakov as his assistant. According to Rimsky, they were both at a loss to know how to proceed with this unfamiliar undertaking, tackling as a first priority the preparation of the choir for the coronation of the new Tsar, for which Balakirev typically high-handedly delegated Rimsky to compose a canticle. We can only speculate as to how this double act developed, since Rimsky gives us no hints in his memoirs, but I think we can guess that it must have been fraught with frictions, given Balakirev's character. For his part, Rimsky set about to improve the lot of the youngsters in the choir, trying to kindle a desire for love and art in illiterate boys who had previously been beaten without mercy and taught the violin, cello or piano only after a fashion. Rimsky managed to write 40 choral works for the chapel, though even in some of his sacred music he wove in elements of folk song. We're going to hear the great entrance chant. Let all mortal flesh keep silence and stand with fear and trembling, for the King of Kings comes to be slain. The Legend of the Invisible City of Kitej, his penultimate opera, is sometimes called Rimsky-Korsakov's Parsifal. There are a few parallels. The miracle music that's reminiscent of the Good Friday music in Wagner's opera, and near the end, Rimsky includes his own variation on the Dresden Amen. His librettist, Vladimir Bielski, initially wanted the work to be based solely on the life of Saint Fevronia of Murom, patron saint of marriage in the Orthodox Church. Rimsky wasn't happy about confining himself to such an explicitly Christian subject, and he considerably diluted that, introducing elements of Russian history, the 13th century invasion by the Mongols, a mystery play, and regional folklore, including a strong undercurrent of Slavic pantheism. The opera makes its way through a war with the Tatars, sacred rites and the supernatural intervention of prophet birds, and the very long title makes it clear that this is an amalgam of elements. The Legend of the Invisible City of Kitej and the Maiden Fevronia. Not so much a bumblebee, more of a midge maybe, at least in one translation I found of the Russian legend The Tale of Tsar Saltan, where the hero, Prince Gwydon, is transformed by the Swan Princess into a flying insect of some kind, so he can catch up with the ship sailing to his father's kingdom. Too late, I think, to turn the tide of history. The music by Rimsky-Korsakov that everybody knows from his opera Tsar Saltan is never going to be known in English as anything other than The Flight of the Bumblebee. And today I'll be poking around, looking at what Rimsky's legacy amounts to, beyond the infinite variety of versions of the improbable flight of that insect, and the occasional scheduling in concerts of the exotic and fabulous Scheherazade. As he grew older, Rimsky became acutely aware of his own place in Russian musical history. This is a man who penned an autobiography called My Musical Life. He also developed a sensitivity to what he saw as the naivety of his early works and set about a major revision program, rewriting some works once and others multiple times until, eventually, he'd revised absolutely everything. His opera, The Maid of Pskov, underwent 3 revisions. This is the overture in its final form. The arched revisionist Rimsky-Korsakov didn't confine his radical remakings to his own works. He also reorchestrated and edited pieces by other members of the Mighty Handful, the group of 5 Russian composers who'd gathered around the influential figure of Mili Balakirev. It began as an extension of the collaborative atmosphere of the group and an effort to rescue works that would otherwise have been lost. Of all his fellow composers, Rimsky was especially close to Mussorgsky. They were the 2 youngest members of the group. They shared a room through the winter of 1870 to 71, and when Rimsky got married, Mussorgsky was his best man. Later, they became gradually estranged, but after Mussorgsky's death, since the late composer's brother seemed indifferent to their fate, Rimsky revised and completed several of Mussorgsky's works for publication and performance, helping to spread his music throughout Russia and to the West. Rimsky ditched Mussorgsky's original reference in the title to St. John's Eve on the Bear Mountain to make it just Night on the Bear Mountain. Mussorgsky had got a hammering from Balakirev over his first version of this piece for piano and orchestra. He'd been so traumatized he'd stuffed it away in a drawer. But after languishing there for several years, he'd dragged it out and written in some vocal parts. Later still, developing that idea, he incorporated it into his opera Sorochintsy Fair. Over the best part of 2 years, Rimsky struggled with these 3 versions, sieving out all the best bits and adding, according to him, the fewest interpolations of my own. He took the opportunity to, as he put it, correct a great deal of the harmony and part writing, changing or removing what he considered musically poor. Because of this, Rimsky's versions of Mussorgsky's works are controversial, but there's no denying the sheer brilliance of the orchestration. The extent to which he was a conscious architect of his own legacy, of the spread of his own music and Russian music in general, is probably a matter for debate. Despite refusing offers of honorary doctorates from Oxford and Cambridge because he didn't want to travel to this country, Rimsky did make the journey to Paris in 1907. The impresario Sergei Diaghilev asked him to conduct in a series of 5 historic concerts of Russian orchestral music to be put on at the Opera, and in support of which he'd lined up some very impressive patrons, including the Comtesse Griffoul and a Grand Duke or 2. Diaghilev regarded Rimsky as crucial to the artistic prestige of the series. The composer obstinately turned him down for a while, but then agreed with the jokey line, "If one has to go, one has to go," as the sparrow said as the cat dragged him downstairs. However reticent Rimsky may have been, this Paris series, which included several of his works, did go a long way to promoting both his own music and other Russian composers in Europe. We can't be sure what kind of performances Rimsky conducted in Paris. By all accounts, he was actually a poor conductor, losing his place from time to time and bungling starts. But let's hear something we know he did conduct: the Polonaise from the opera Christmas Eve. In 1894, while he was struggling to make progress on writing Christmas Eve, beginning to believe that if he had ever had any creative power, it had left him forever, Rimsky found that when he had eventually laboriously got the whole thing sketched out, the work of orchestration fairly whistled along. "How curious," he said. "I evidently prefer to orchestrate rather than compose." 2 years after that, Rimsky began, for the second time, to make notes for a book on orchestration. Once again, he abandoned the project, but this time he didn't destroy what he'd written. He came back to it and almost finished it in the last 4 years of his life, but it was eventually completed, after his death, by his son-in-law, Maximilian Steinberg. Rimsky-Korsakov's influence on Russian composers to come was not just through that text, though. He had a huge influence as a teacher of orchestration. There is such a thing as the Rimsky-Korsakov School, made up of about 250 of his former composition students over his 35-year tenure at the St. Petersburg Conservatory, and they disseminated his influence well beyond St. Petersburg, since they ended up in cities all over what was then Russia: Kiev, Riga, Vilnius, Tallinn, Minsk, Tbilisi, and Yerevan. The conductor, Nikolai Malko, remembers Rimsky-Korsakov beginning the first class of the year by saying, "I will speak, and you will listen. Then I will speak less, and you will start to work. And finally, I will not speak at all, and you will work." You can hear Rimsky's influence felt in the music of his more prominent pupils, such as Glazunov, Prokofiev, and Stravinsky. Stravinsky's score for The Firebird clearly shows who his teacher was. There are a couple of instances where he uses Russian folk songs, which Rimsky had used before him. Perhaps the most salient case comes in the fourth movement of Stravinsky's Firebird Suite, The Infernal Dance, which borrows its main melody from a passage in Rimsky-Korsakov's opera Blada that represents a witch's Sabbath, though, of course, Stravinsky transforms it. We'll hear that ghastly witch's coven on the summit of Mount Triglav. In terms of performance, Rimsky-Korsakov's legacy is very different whether we're talking about inside or outside Russia. Whilst in Europe he is known for Scheherazade and a few orchestral excerpts, and above all, that bumblebee, in Russia it's his 15 operas rather than his orchestral music which represent his lasting legacy. Halfway through that run of stage works comes his seventh opera, a one-actor, Mozart and Salieri, takes us into a sound world of classical pastiche that we might hardly expect from Rimsky. He described the composition of the opera as purely vocal, the melodic line following the flow of Pushkin's text. Rimsky sets Pushkin's version of the myth that Antonio Salieri, director of music to the imperial court in Vienna, was so jealous of Mozart's infinitely greater talent that he poisoned him. Mozart and Salieri is a psychological drama centred on the tortured introspection of Salieri's monologues. Rimsky-Korsakov's own path to artistic maturity had been difficult, and he was prone to periods of self-doubt, if not depression, and reassessment. He may well have empathised with Salieri. In this scene, Mozart tells Salieri about the mysterious stranger, a man in black, who turned up to commission a requiem from him. He sits at the piano and plays the opening of the requiem and sees that Salieri is crying. Rimsky-Korsakov had had asthma and heart problems for some time, and his breathing was sometimes difficult. And in the spring of 1908, his heart condition grew much worse. There were several attacks. In early June, there was another. He wasn't well enough to go to his daughter's wedding on the 4th of June, and by the end of the week, after a short, sudden thunderstorm, he died. He was buried in the cemetery of the Tikhvin Monastery, just across the river from his childhood home. Stravinsky wrote a funeral ode for him, performed 6 months later. I'll end this week with a song by Rimsky-Korsakov, setting words by his beloved Pushkin. On the hills of Georgia fell the mist of night. I'm sad, my sadness filled with you. Тревожи, и сердце вновь корит.